What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Friday evening, November 22nd, so it'll be before all of the NBA Cup games that are played tonight happen, so you'll probably be listening after those games happen. So if anything big happens, probably will not get to it in this one. But I'm going to do a segment that I did last year, which I call Sample Size Roulette, where I basically will be asking the question, is the sample size big enough to come to certain conclusions across the league based on what we've seen out of the NBA out of the first month of the season so far? So with that being said, let's go ahead and get right into it. And so I'm going to start off with a question that a lot of people have been asking, and that is the sample size big enough to say that this Philadelphia 76ers season is over? They are currently 2-12. They are dead last in the NBA in offensive rating with a putrid 106. They are 18th in defensive rating. They're 27th in net rating with a -9. So far in the season, they have not even won a game in regulation. Their two wins both came in overtime, one over the Pacers, one over the Charlotte Hornets. Both close games, obviously. But across their 12 losses, only four of those games were single-digit games. Only one of them was a one-possession game. So they have not even been really that competitive in the games that they have lost. I mean, even the last game they just played against Memphis, a six-point game is the final score. But that is not indicative of how that game played out. That was an ugly, ugly game for Philadelphia. And that is really the story of the season so far. It has been ugly for them across the board. As we know, Embiid had kind of a weird undisclosed injury that we're not really sure when it happened. The reporting around it was weird. There wasn't a lot of coverage in terms of what the injury was, when he's supposed to come back. But after missing the first 10 games, he did come back last week. He's played four games now and looked like a complete shell of himself, only averaging 20 points, 7.5 rebounds, shooting 38% from the field, 17% from three, and just, it's an ugly brand of basketball when Embiid doesn't have it going. He's flopping all over the place. He's trying to draw calls. His body language is poor, and he's looked particularly bad on the defensive end, slow-footed. He just doesn't look close to 100%, which makes you kind of wonder, why is he even playing at this point? I get maybe they thought the hole was so big that they needed to rush him back, but if he is being this version of himself, it's not very effective. And unfortunately for them, no one else has really picked up the slack, because Paul George, he missed the first six games of the season, and since coming back, he has looked like a shell of himself, only averaging 15 points a game. He's shooting 38% from the field as well, only 28% from three. He just has looked uninvolved at times. The last game against Memphis, I mean, I think the first 5 minutes of the game, he didn't even get a shot attempt up. And when he has shot, it's kind of been out of the flow of the offense. It just hasn't been, it hasn't meshed the way you would have wanted it to. And then Tyrese Maxey, you'd think he would be the one bright spot, you know. 24-year-old player, made his first All-Star game last season. He can maybe pick up that slack while PG and Embiid were injured to start the season. But he has not been able to get into a groove either. He's also shooting only 39% from the field. He's also shooting 27% from three. And he also then suffered an injury and missed six games or so. But even when he's played, he hasn't been good. He has a 10-for-31 game, a 6-for-23 game, a 3-for-13 game, a 5-for-13 game. Like, he has been bad. He just has been. And all three of their top three guys that were supposed to be this elite trio that was going to have them not only towards the top of the Eastern Conference, but legitimate contenders, they've all underperformed. And they haven't gotten a ton out of the role players either. Caleb Martin has been pretty good so far this season, not shooting the ball spectacularly, but at least being a good two-way guy for them. Kelly Oubre's shot has also fallen off a cliff, only 27% this year. Kyle Lowry just isn't the guy he used to be. He's playing 24-plus minutes, but still unable to give them more than 6 points a game. Drummond looks old. He's just not a very good player at this point in his career. I know he's a good rebounder, but that is really all he does. He's not a great offensive player. And then Eric Gordon's been a zero. KJ Martin, been a zero. Reggie Jackson, been a zero. Yabusele's given him some, you know, nice fun minutes, and he's been one of the brighter spots on the team, but he's only going to do so much for you as the backup forward and center off the bench. And then Jared McCain has been the one bright spot. 16 points a game, 48% from the field, 41% from three. He had has multiple 30-point games at this point. And so outside of McCain and a little bit of Yabusele, this has been a disaster. A utter disaster. Could not be any worse for this team. And so I'm not going to sugarcoat how bad it's been. It's been awful. They have the worst record in the NBA right now, worse than any other team, which is crazy when you consider the talent they have. I know that the Embiid has missed 10 games, Maxey's missed 6 games, Paul George has missed 6 games and got injured in this previous game against Memphis as well, so he's probably going to miss some more time. But regardless, they got too much talent. Nick Nurse is supposedly supposed to be one of the better coaches in the NBA. But it doesn't look like this team plays together. It doesn't look like they're having fun out there. It doesn't look like they are connected on either end of the court. It looks like they don't like playing together. It's the feel you get when you watch them. And it's not a fun brand of basketball, outside of some flashes by McCain. I mean, Maxey's shot has not been there. Embiid, as I said, is just... he's just awful to watch when he's at his worst. And so even with all that, the question is the sample size big enough to say that their season is over? And it really depends what you mean by over. If you view them as championship or bust and you say over means they will not win the championship, then I think it's an easy yes. You just don't come back from 2-12 and this kind of dysfunctionality that they've had and go on to win a championship, especially when there's other teams in the conference that are looking extremely formidable. The West is still a beast. Like, I just can't see this team winning a championship this year. I do not think it's in the cards. But if you're asking if their season's over in terms of are they just going to miss the playoffs altogether, then I would say no. I still think there is plenty of time for this team to come back and salvage a little bit of this. I mean, are they going to win 50 games? Most likely no. But do I think they're going to be the worst team in the Eastern Conference? No, not at all. Do I think that they're going to win 30, 35 games? Also, probably not. I still think that they're going to, just off talent alone, they should be able to get to 40 wins. I still believe that even with their 2-12 record. I mean, that would be 38-30 the rest of the season for them to get to 40 wins, which, like, that's not some juggernaut record to play the rest away. So do I think they can go 38-30 the rest of the year? Of course I do. This is, again, a team that everybody thought was going to be a championship contender, and all of those factors that have helped them back are there. But the point is, there is so much time left in the season. We're 14 games in for the Sixers. Can they just go 38-30 to get to 40 wins? And trust me, 40 wins is going to be plenty good enough to at least get in the play-in. But do I think they could be better than that even? It's still possible. I mean, I know it has been worse, like even worse than what you thought worst case scenario was going to be. I'm sure if you're a Sixers fan, if someone asked you what your worst case through 14 games, you probably would have said like 6-8 maybe, and you would have been like Embiid's hurt, like Maxey got hurt, Paul George got hurt, whatever. But 2-12 was not even fathomable for this team. So it's no sure thing they would even get to that number, but I just... the East looks so weak this year compared to where we maybe thought they would be. There are 4 teams above 500. Like the Sixers, even for how bad the record is, there are only 4 games out of the 6th seed, which would avoid the play-in altogether. So you're telling me that over 68 games, they can't make up 4 games? Like I think they definitely can. So again, the answer to the question really depends on how you're framing it. Is their season over to the point where they cannot win a championship? I would say yes. Is their season over to the point where they can't still make the playoffs and have a competitive first-round series, maybe win a series before probably falling short second round like they always do? Of course, it's not over. I mean, there is just so much runway for them. They have not lost as much ground as you would think they would, given how poor the conference is. And they have had injury bad luck. I mean, if we're if we're being quite honest, I mean, Maxey, George, and Embiid combined have missed 16 games, and they've only played 14 games. So I'm sure they will have some better injury luck. I'm sure that it can't get any worse. It literally cannot get any worse, and they're still statistically very much in it despite their poor record, just because of how bad the East is. And if I had to guess at this point, I still think they will be in the 6-8 range in the East, probably not any higher than that. But look, can they jump Toronto, Chicago, Charlotte, Brooklyn, Detroit? Like, there's a lot of not very good teams ahead of them that they, if they just play half of what we thought they would be to start the season, they should still be able to finish above those teams at the end of the regular season. The next question is the sample size big enough to say that the Knicks resoundingly won the Karl Anthony Towns trade? And to me, this is a yes already. I was very high on this trade for the Knicks at the time of the deal because I thought Towns just was going to unlock some stuff for them offensively that Randall was holding them back with. And that's kind of exactly what's played out. And we've already seen some of the clunkiness on the other side with Minnesota as well. And, I mean, the fit with Brunson and Towns in New York has been just nothing short of perfect. They are second in the NBA in offensive rating. Towns and Brunson are number one in the league in pretty much every single category in the pick and roll, in the pick and pop, or just scoring when he screens for Brunson in general. And Towns is probably having his best offensive season of his career. I mean, he's up just under 27 points a game, 12 rebounds a game, which, by the way, he was a 11 to 12 rebound per game guy earlier in his career when he's playing center. He's only been 8-9 the past few years next to Gobert. But we knew that he could be an elite rebounder when he is playing the five full time. He's shooting a ridiculous 50% from three-point range. He's shooting 55% from the field, 85% from the line. He's already had multiple 30-point games. He had a 45-point game earlier in the year as well. Like, he's been as advertised, not only as a floor spacer, but also he's been really good scoring in the paint as well, and just as a screener, opening up lanes for Brunson to operate as well, who has maybe started a little bit slower statistically just because of how good we saw him be towards the end of last year. But when we say start slow, I mean, the guy's averaging 25 a game on 48% and 40% from three. So if that's slow, then that is a a tough bar that you are holding him up against. So, but yeah, I mean, look, the Knicks have not been perfect by any means. Mikal Bridges has had a tough time sort of acclimating to the team. He hasn't shot the ball super well. He's still trying to find where he fits in offensively. And they have not been good defensively. They're only 21st in the NBA in defensive rating. But I just want to say to all the people who are like, yeah, but that's why we didn't like the Towns trade, because we knew it would make them bad defensively. My counterpoint to that is that if they didn't make this trade, they still would be bad defensively right now, because they still wouldn't have a center. They'd have Mitchell Robinson out still. They'd be playing Jericho Sims or Hook Porty, their rookie, or they'd be going small ball like crazy with Randall playing the five, or Anunoby maybe effectively playing the five, and those weren't going to be good defensive lineups either. So the problem with their defense is not that Towns is some huge downgrade from what they would have had. It's that they didn't have a center. And of course, Towns is not a very good defensive center, but the alternative is Randall at center or Sims in bigger minutes. So they were going to be not good defensively until Mitchell Robinson got back, regardless of if they made this deal or not. And so Towns has at least given them some size down there, has given them a ton of reliable rebounding, and he's been everything you could have hoped for offensively. So to me, this has been a home run trade for them. They were always going to have to wait till Robinson got back or add some sort of bigger body to be like a very good defensive team, which right now they're not. But the point of the question was only to evaluate the trade. And DiVincenzo and Randall left and Towns came in. And so Randall and DiVincenzo are not solving the Knicks' defensive issues that they have. They need a true center, which is why Mitchell Robinson is still so important to this team in terms of being a contender. But on the Wolves side of things, it has looked a little clunky across the board. I mean, they're 8-7. They're 11th in the NBA in net rating at +2.3. But they have not looked good recently. I mean, so far this season, they have losses to the Spurs, the Heat at home. They lost back-to-back games to the Trailblazers, and then they just lost to the Raptors on Thursday night this week. So they have had a ton of not good losses at all. They haven't had any sort of consistency so far to this season. And last night was just a perfect highlight of that. I mean, there was the play down the stretch where Gobert's wide open down the paint on a good seal. Randall is dribbling the air out of the ball, doesn't pass him the ball. Rudy gets called for the 3 seconds, and he's pissed because he didn't pass him the ball, and Ant gets mad at. I mean, there's just been a little bit of tension and frustration, it seems like, and of course that's going to come when you are hovering around 500 like they have been to this point. I mean, they haven't been more than 2 games away from 500 the whole season. They've kind of just been alternating wins and losses. And on the other part of this, I mean, a big reason why people were defending this trade or liked it even is because of what Dante DiVincenzo could do for them as a shooter. But he has not shot the ball well at all. He's 32% from three, only 35% from the field overall. And I think what DiVincenzo is as a player got glorified a little bit because of the bigger role he took up in the playoffs last year when he had some big games. And just because the general like lure of the Knicks that everybody is, they were such a team that so many people liked, and the vibes of the Villanova guys and all that. And the reality is DiVincenzo has been on what 4 or 5 teams so far in this point in his career. And he's still only 28. So like he's bounced around. He has not really been able to stick anywhere. The Knicks were definitely the team he looked the best on, but he's been inconsistent with his shooting this season. And that's really an understatement. So if he's not going to be anything more than just a streaky shooter off the bench, and Randall has put up, I mean, Randall's averaging 22-7-4 on 50%, and he shot pretty well from outside, 36.5%. So it's not like he's been bad. It's just that this season has made it so clear how much better Towns is than Randall. He's just such a better player. He's so much more dynamic offensively. He unlocks things for other guys, whereas Randall kind of bogs things down for other guys. And that's the big difference between the two of them. And that is kind of what I was preaching and harping on when this deal was made and why I liked it so much for New York. And I don't know. The numbers don't lie. The Knicks are an elite, elite offensive team now, and they probably wouldn't have been that with Randall. And the Wolves have looked clunky, and they are losing to bad teams, and they are hovering around 500. And I don't know if they all those things would be true if they still had Towns. So to me, this is a no-brainer, huge win for the Knicks, just as I said it was when the deal was made. I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of the year Randall like walks for nothing, which would make it even more of a loss for Minnesota, basically trading Towns for 1 year of Randall and then whatever DiVincenzo turns into. But I do think that we've seen enough, because a lot of that is just confirmation bias for me, at least. Like, this is exactly how I thought it'd play out, and I've seen nothing to make me change my mind that this was a good deal for the Wolves in really any capacity, because to me, they're worse. They were a top contender in the West, and now like they seem like more of a middle-of-the-pack team. Meanwhile, with the East being so poor, the Knicks look like as good as any team to challenge the other top teams in the East right now. The next question is the sample size big enough to say that the Cleveland Cavaliers could make the NBA Finals this season? This is a team that started 15-0 before finally losing to Boston earlier this week in a close game that was competitive down the stretch. That was the second best start to a season in NBA history, behind only the 2016 Warriors that miraculously somehow started 24-0 on their way to breaking the NBA record for most wins in a regular season. And they bounce back again to blow out New Orleans right after losing to Boston. So they currently sit at 16-1 on the season. They are first in net rating at plus 12.3. They are first in the NBA in offensive rating. They are eighth in the NBA in defensive rating. And Kenny Atkinson has these guys looking like a different team from what they've been over the past few seasons. And to me, it really all starts with Garland and Mobley, but really particularly Garland. Darius Garland is a guy that I've always been pretty high on, but there was no denying that he had a down year last year. I mean, he posted the lowest points he had in three seasons, the lowest assists he had had in three seasons, the lowest shooting percentage he had had since his rookie year, lowest three-point percentage since his rookie year. Like, everything was across the board down for him last season. Didn't shoot the ball as well. Looked a little deferential on offense to Mitchell sometimes. Like, this is a guy that who had been the lead guard on this team, and he was not looking like that same guy at all. And he did have that jaw injury that people were claiming was just uncomfortable to play through, even though he did miss some time for it. Even when he came back, didn't quite look like the same guy. But this year, he's looked like the best version of himself. I mean, he's back up to 21 points a game, 7 assists, 43% from deep. He's shooting the ball way better. His passing and playmaking, even though his assists aren't way up from what they were last year, and they're still down from where they were before Mitchell got there, he's still... like the eye test, he just looks like so much more impactful on that part of the game. Just his passing is legitimately one of the best in the entire NBA. I think he's one of the best, more pure point guards that we have, even though he certainly can go score. I mean, averaging well over 20 points per game combined over the last four seasons. But he stepped up, which has also allowed Donovan Mitchell to not have to carry such a big burden and such a load. I mean, this year he's averaging only 24 points per game, and that's after over the last 2 years with Cleveland averaging 27 last year, 28 the year before. He's shooting his best season from three-point range that he's had so far in his career. He's taking less field goal attempts, and just his usage is down because he hasn't had to do as much. And as great as the core four for Cleveland had been over the last few years, it still felt like they were so Mitchell-reliant offensively, and when Garland wasn't shooting with the same efficiency and being as aggressive as he had in the past, it felt like they had one guy to go to down the stretch. But now it feels like Garland is certainly the 1B to Mitchell's 1A, especially as like a closer and finisher down the stretch. He's had some games this year where he's completely taken over, particularly the Knicks game in Madison Square Garden comes to mind. And then the Mobley and Allen fit has looked a little better than in previous years. I mean, Mobley's upped his scoring up just under 18 points a game. Still been a extremely elite shot blocker, very solid rebounder. Still been efficient from the field, 56%. He's upped his three-point volume and percentage ever so slightly. Last year he did shoot 37%, but the volume was so low that it was not super impactful in terms of actually stretching the floor. But this season, he's upped it just a little bit. He's just under two attempts per game and still just right under 38%. So if he can continue to do that, it's only going to make it scarier for the rest of the NBA for this team offensively. But also, this team's just gotten really good contributions from other guys. Caris LeVert has shot the hell out of the ball to this point. 46% from three-point range, 53% from the field. Ty Jerome has come out of nowhere to be like a legitimate impact rotation backup guard. 12 a game. He had close to 30 the other night. And then Niang, Sam Merrill, Dean Wade, they're all kind of doing their part to this point. But I think Atkinson has been such a big influential part of their kind of breakout season. I think that he's empowered Garland to get back to what he had done earlier in his career before Mitchell got there. I think he's done a good job of staggering like the Mobley Allen pairing a little bit more because both those guys are so damn good. They can both play the five, but Mobley obviously can play the four for the majority of the game when he's next Allen if he has to. And this is a team that's probably going to win close to 60 games. I mean, when you have a 15-0 record cushion to start the season, winning 60 is not that hard from that point on, especially with how weak the East has been so far. Like, when Milwaukee looks way worse than we thought they'd be, Philadelphia looks way worse than they thought they'd be, like, Miami looks extremely mediocre. Orlando has looked very good, but Paolo is still out for at least a few more weeks. Like, there's opportunities for wins to be had in the East, and Cleveland has, to this point, fully taken advantage of that. But the question with them is still going to remain. Can they do it in the postseason? Because the last couple years, they've been a really good regular season team. In their first year with Mitchell, they won 51 games and were a top four seed in the East. And there were it wasn't a sure thing that the team was going to win 50-plus coming into that year. And then last year, they went only 48. But they had maybe the worst injury luck of any team in the entire NBA last year. I mean, Mitchell missed a good chunk of the time down the stretch last season. Garland missed weeks to months with that jaw injury I talked about. Mobley missed extended time. Like, all of their top rotation guys, except for Jared Allen, missed like significant time. So pretty like impressive that they even got to 48 wins. So the point is, they were really good in the regular season the past 2 years, and they looked not really good in the postseason. The 2 years ago, they get absolutely manhandled by New York despite being pretty heavy favorites in that series. They had home court. They had theoretically the best player in the series at the time with Mitchell. It was kind of pre-Brunson full breakout. Randall didn't even play well in that series, but it didn't matter. Mitchell Robinson owned these bigs, and they just didn't look like a team that was ready. Then last year, I know they make the second round, but it took every ounce of everything to knock off a lackluster offensive team in Orlando. Cleveland failed to score 100, I think, all but one of the games throughout that series. And look, I mean, it took a 1-for-15 performance from Franz Wagner and a 20-point comeback in Game 7 for them to even advance. So that was led by a 20-year-old Paolo Banchero. Like, they should have won that series more handily than they did, despite what we know about Orlando being a really solid team now, regardless. So their regular season success hasn't translated a ton into the postseason thus far. So again, back to the question, can they make the finals? And as of right now, I'm going to say probably not. And I say probably not instead of no, only because there's always the injury chance. So to me, I don't see this team beating Boston, is just kind of where I'm at. But like, if Jason Tatum got hurt in the postseason, or even maybe Jaylen Brown, then could they maybe beat Boston at that point? Sure. But those guys are so durable, so I don't expect that. But that's why I'm not going full no, because you never really know with the injury stuff. But as of right now, assuming health for like them and other teams in the East, I still think that they are probably peaking out at the conference finals, just because I haven't seen it look good in the postseason yet. I just haven't seen it. And look, this is the best version of them that we've seen, but would I be absolutely shocked if they lost to like a Milwaukee team that starts to figure things out in the second half and maybe adds a piece at the deadline and Giannis just goes crazy on them? Like, no, that wouldn't shock me. Would I be surprised if they lost to the Knicks, who before the season, everybody would have had above Cleveland, and they've had a little bit of a slow start in some aspects, particularly defensively. But the Knicks manhandled them 2 years ago, and it's a different-looking Knicks team. But regardless, like, would I pick Cleveland over New York in a series today? Probably. But come May, when the Knicks have had more of a chance to iron out the Kings, Bridges gets in the flow a little bit more, they've got Mitchell Robinson, maybe they add a piece at the deadline too, like, I think the Knicks, by the time the playoffs roll around, are probably more serious of a contender than Cleveland. And even if they were to beat all those teams and get to the conference finals and play Boston, I just don't think they're beating Boston as currently constructed if they are fully healthy. Even if they're not fully, even if Porzingis is out, they still might lose to Boston, in my opinion. And I think Cleveland needs some wing reinforcements, and maybe I could get there then, because I just don't, they've got so many different options, but all of them are flawed. Between LeVert, who's like not a consistent shooter throughout his career, not a very good defensive player either, a little undersized to be playing small forward. Dean Wade is a pretty good defender, but he's kind of not anything offensively outside of a spot-up shooter. And I still think he can be a little exposed on smaller players just because he's more of a power forward being forced to play small forward. And so I don't really trust him in all defensive scenarios either. Then you've got Georges Niang, who is just very hit or miss when he plays. Average at best defensively, average at best offensively. Then you throw Okoro in there, who just hasn't been a good shooter throughout his career, and kind of leaving some to be desired on defense too. And then, of course, there's Max Strus, who hasn't played a game yet this season. But I still just like Strus to me is not a great defender. He's a streaky shooter. I just would like to see them get somebody who's a little bit more consistent on both ends. They've got guys who can fill in for spark offense like LeVert. They've got guys who can get hot from outside like Strus. They've got guys who can defend bigger players like Wade. They've got guys who can defend smaller players like Okoro, but they don't have, like, if you could mix them all together into one, like, really good role player, that's kind of what they need, but they just don't have that. So I'd like to see them add somebody there, and then maybe I could get there. But because of that and the poor track record in the postseason and just there still being some other threats in the East, I'm not ready to say that they can make the finals this season, but I certainly think a tough loss in the Eastern Conference Finals is absolutely on the table for them. The next question is the sample size big enough to say that Tyrese Haliburton just kind of sucks now? Because he has been very bad so far this season. I mean, he's averaging 15 points a game, 8.5 assists, 38% from the field, 28% from three. He's got a 50% true shooting, a 113 offensive rating, and a 119 defensive rating, so a minus six net rating. He's got on pace for the lowest win shares of his career. And if you go back into last season when he really struggled in the second half after coming back from his injuries, we now have a 50-game sample of Haliburton putting up stats of only 16 a game, 9 assists on 43% from the field, 31% from three, and only 55% true shooting. So, I mean, a 50-game sample is quite big. And look, those numbers aren't awful. It's not like he's a bad player. 9 assists, 16 points, just below kind of league average true shooting. And he's clearly been impactful throughout last season in the second half, even though the numbers were down. So no one's saying he's bad, but is he the all-star, all-NBA caliber guy that he's been advertised to be? Because we've talked ad nauseum about how the first 34 games of last season, he averaged 24 points, 13 assists on 50, 40, 86 splits. And he looked like a generationally dominant offensive force, like a Steve Nash times 10 kind of modern playmaking offensive threat, efficient scorer, great shooter. Like, he checked every box. He was terrifying. He looked tremendous. He was on his way to being like first team all NBA. And it's not like those 34 games were the only great like play we've seen out of Haliburton. If you look at since he arrived in Indiana up until that injury he had last year, that's a 116 game sample. And he's averaged 21 points, 11 assists, 49% from the field, 40% from three. So, like, he's been a close to 50-40-90 guy, a 20-10 guy for the majority of his time in Indiana. But he has obviously really, really struggled this year. And the Pacers have struggled as a whole because of it. They're only 6-9. And that's despite what's been sort of a mini breakout year from Ben Mathurin, who looks like a totally different offensive player than he did last year before his injury, and a really good start to the year by Pascal Siakam, who's obviously always been good, but now they have him for a full year, and he's been shooting the lights out this season as well. So who is the true Tyrese Haliburton? And that's kind of the question. Is that sample size big enough to say that the true Haliburton is just what we're seeing? This inefficient guy who can't score like he used to, doesn't have the same burst, not hitting threes at the same clip. And my answer is no. Is that the sample size? I know 50 games is a lot, but I find it hard to believe that for how good he was. It would be kind of unlike anything we've ever seen where a guy looks so absurdly dominant and really consistent over the span of like 2.5-3 years to just kind of a shell of himself, like a little bit out of nowhere. And so I know it kind of is annoying to blame it on injuries, but that's kind of what I'm going to do. I think that last year, he certainly was playing on that injured hamstring. He came back a little early. It was pretty obvious because of the rules about the minimum games played to make all NBA. It seemed like that maybe played a little bit of a factor. And then this year, I think I assume the hamstring's probably fine by this point. I mean, he played in the Olympics as well. But there has been some whispers about sort of a back injury, which has kind of made him a little less confident going into the paint and getting to the basket, and made him settle a little bit more. And he's been a little bit less aggressive, and it's affected the shot a little bit. And so I know what I watched last year. I'm not saying that that 34 game sample is who he'll be. Like, that's probably also not who he is. Just like this probably isn't who he is. Who he is probably in the middle, which is what we had kind of seen before that 21-11 on good shooting. And so that's where I'm falling on him. I still believe in Tyrese Halliburton. I still think he's a top 20 player. I still think at his best, he is one of the absolute highest floor raisers we have in the NBA in terms of just impact on the team offensively. I think he is a walking top five offense in the league, even though we haven't really seen all of that out of him this season. But look, he's not going to shoot sub 30% from three. He's not going to shoot sub 40% from the field. Like, he's not going to average only 15 a game, like, for the rest of his career, probably not for this season even though he's done that to this point. So I think the sample size is too small. I think the shooting will come around. I think he probably is playing through some sort of back injury, which has been mildly reported on. And so I think full strength Halliburton, I still believe that he can get to that absurdly high that we saw out of him, because he's still, what, only 24 years old? I mean, he's theoretically got 4, 5, 6 more years in his prime, and in theory, he still hasn't even reached his prime. So after 15 games of terrible play and 30 games of being clearly injured with subpar play, I'm going to trust the larger sample. I'm going to trust that he can get back to where he needs to be. And I still think, like I said, he's one of the most impactful players on the offensive end that there is in the NBA. And the next question is the sample size big enough to say that the Warriors' start to the season is legitimate and that they are actual contenders this year once again? And this is a team that, you know, they came into the year with not much expectations. I think anyone would have thought if they just made the playoffs, it would be viewed as a success after last year making the play-in before falling short and missing the playoffs. They lost Klay Thompson, obviously, and they added a lot of nice pieces around Steph, a lot of good role players, and that's kind of been their approach this year. It's been a Steph plus Draymond plus by committee. They don't have a single player averaging over 30 minutes per game, and they have 12 guys averaging 15 or more minutes per game. And Steph is the only player averaging 17 or more to this point, and they've gotten some really good contributions across the board, though. Wiggins looks a little bit more like the old Wiggins of last year. I don't know what happened to that dude. I know there's been reports he had some family stuff going on, but he was a mess on both ends of the court. I mean, like, legitimately one of the worst players in the NBA who got, like, high minutes and high usage last season. And look, he's probably not what he was back on the championship run, but he looks a little closer to that than what he was last year. He's shot the ball a lot better. He's been more engaged defensively as well. And then Buddy Hield has looked like Klay Thompson 2.0 on this team. I mean, 45% from three, averaging 3.6 makes from downtown per game this season, up to 16.5 points per game. I mean, he has been a revelation for them as a shooter. They're running a lot of the same plays that they ran for Klay, and even some they run for Steph, but for Hield instead. Then Kuminga and Przemski have been a little bit disappointing this season. I mean, Kuminga got moved to a bench role. Pods, I think a lot of people thought were probably going to start, or was probably going to start as well. They've started 6 games combined. Pods has not shot the ball well, but still been a solid contributor in other areas. And then Kuminga, you know, he's more of a secondary off-the-bench scorer now, 13.7 points per game, fourth on the team. But then D'Anthony Melton had given them some really good minutes before he just, it was reported, is going to be out the rest of the season with an ACL injury. Trace Jackson Davis has been a solid starting five for them, taking over really a lot of the Looney minutes, even though Looney is still a little bit in the rotation. Then you got Kyle Anderson, Moses Moody, Lindy Waters even giving them some minutes. So they're deep. They go legitimately like 12, 13 deep if they need to. You throw Gary Payton in there. But can they win a championship or even make a deep run with this formula? And I'll just say that I'm very skeptical because I know that they're 11-3. And my case for this is a little harder after they beat Boston and Oklahoma City. But their hot start was largely a pretty cupcake schedule. I mean, their first seven games were against Portland, Utah, the Clippers, New Orleans twice, the Rockets, and the Wizards. So the initial hot start wasn't too surprising just given that. But then, of course, they win in Boston. They win in Oklahoma City. They beat Dallas. And so they've gotten some good wins since then. So that argument's a little bit gone. But I still just, the thing for me with Golden State is I'm terrified of their lack of reliable options after Steph. Like I said, they have had a by-committee role-player approach, and they've got Wiggins averaging 16 a game, Hield averaging 16, Kuminga averaging 14, Melton was 10, like Pods is 8, Draymond's green 8, Trace Jackson Davis is 8, Moody's 9. Like, it's a lot of guys that you're relying on to give you small contributions, but that's not what wins in the playoffs. Once you get to the postseason, it's normally a 7, 8, maybe 9 man rotation max. You don't see teams playing 10 guys in the postseason very much. And so, one, who's going to play and who's not going to play? And that's going to be a difficult question for Steve Kerr. And he can mix and match, but it's really hard for guys to get into a rhythm if they're completely not playing one game and then they come in and get 20 plus minutes the next game. But it really just comes down to they have the worst second option of probably any team even remotely in consideration for the postseason. I mean, you probably would call their second option either Wiggins, Hield, or Kuminga. But just go down the line of all the teams in the West that are at least thinking about wanting to make the playoffs. Like OKC has Jalen Williams and Chet when he comes back. Houston has Jalen Green and Fred VanVleet, who, I mean, VanVleet's not in a great second option, and he's third option on that team, but even he would be better than what Golden State has as a reliable option. The Lakers, obviously, Anthony Davis or LeBron, whoever you want to pick. Denver has Jamal Murray. Phoenix has KD or Booker, whoever you want to pick. Memphis has Bain and Jaren Jackson Jr. Dallas has Kyrie. Minnesota has Julius Randle. Like the Pelicans, if they finally get healthy at some point, Zion or Brandon Ingram, like all these teams have like a second guy that not only can average 20 plus points per game, could average close to 25 points per game, and can give you 30 to 35 on any, literally on any given night, they can drop that. And you need that to win in the postseason. I mean, that's part of the reason why Boston was able to get over the hump last year is because of how reliable Jaylen Brown was as a number two option. And part of the main reason Denver won 2 years ago is because of how consistently reliable Jamal Murray was as a second option, much more reliable than he had been in the regular season. And so that is such a key part to contending. You need it. And so for me with Golden State, I just don't see that person on the roster. I think Draymond's a good second best player, but that's more for his impact as a defensive player and an initiator. He's also looked a little bit over the hump this year. His numbers are down across the board. But like, I don't trust Wiggins to be that guy. I don't trust Buddy Hield to be that guy. Buddy Hield couldn't even get playing time for the Sixers in the postseason last year. He was getting DMP's coach's decision. And then Kuminga has not even played well enough to start. And I don't really trust him. I'm not a huge Kuminga guy. I think he's a little bit of a black hole. I don't trust his outside shot. And of course, they could package two or three of these guys out and get a Jimmy Butler or some other reliable scorer that becomes available. And then maybe I'll have that discussion and I could be swayed that they're legitimate. But as of right now, as currently constructed, it's a nice story that they've gotten off to this start. And because of how deep they are, I think they could totally remain in the top four in the West. I don't think they're going to be the one seed, but they absolutely could finish in the top four in the Western Conference, just given the depth they had. And of course, when you've got Steph Curry, Draymond, and Steve Kerr as your coach, like, you're going to have a chance to win any game you're in. But I just don't see it translating because of the second option thing. I think it is too important in today's NBA. And you just, what happens when Steph has an off night, when, and he has off nights like that, that's kind of, he's a spectacular player, but he's streaky. And that's kind of like, when he's on, he's like the most unstoppable player in the entire world. You can't do anything about it. But he is very susceptible to these 5-for-22 games. Like, they happen. So when he has that game, who's stepping up? When they're in the playoffs and they're throwing two bodies at Steph every time and he's not going to be able to get the easy looks, like, who is going to hit shots for them? Not only is who going to hit shots, who's going to create shots for them? And I'm not putting my eggs in the Andrew Wiggins or Jonathan Kuminga basket. it's not going to be me. The next question is the sample size big enough to say that the Houston Rockets are locks to make the playoffs this season? And they are off to a very good start. They are 11-5. They are currently the 3 seed in the Western Conference. They are 2nd in the NBA in defensive rating. They are 5th in the NBA in net rating at plus 8.4, 14th in offensive rating. And just like the Warriors I just talked about, they are deep as hell. They just have high-level role player after high-level role player across this roster. You know what you're getting out of guys like Fred VanVleet and Dylan Brooks, but then Alperen Şengün continues to ascend. His scoring is a little bit down this year, but a lot of that has to do with the fact that other guys are stepping up. So his usage is down, his looks from the field are down, and they just legitimately haven't needed him to do as much as he's done in the past. Still got Jabari Smith and Jalen Green to round out that starting five, but it's really been a lot of the bench guys that have had a huge impact, particularly Tari Eason and Amen Thompson. These guys have been spectacular, particularly defensively. Tari Eason has been just a menace on that end of the court, among the league leaders in steals per game at 2.2, also leading, or the second leading scorer on the team at blocks, behind only Şengün at 1.1 per game. He's also been super efficient offensively, 53% from the field, 37% from three, just under 12 points a game. Thompson's also been very efficient offensively, 56%, 11 points per game, and a really nice little secondary playmaker and offensive initiator for them. And look, Reed Shepherd, he's my guy. You all know that. He hasn't played a ton, unfortunately, so he's not really been able to have a huge impact at this point. Hasn't shot particularly well from the field, only 40%. But I think his minutes will go up as the season goes on, and as he gets more opportunity, I think he can also be another high-impact guy for this team. But they've got guys like Cam Whitmore, Jayshon Tate. They can't even crack the rotation because of just how deep this team is. Steven Adams, kind of a forgotten backup center in the league after his injury last season, and he was shipped out to Houston. But look, they have a really, really solid top 9 or 10, and they are one of these teams that their starters don't finish their games all the time because of how impactful Eason is on the defensive end and the secondary playmaking that Amon Thompson has and the offensive rebound that Steven Adams has. Like, they have so many options they can throw at you, and they're young. I mean, outside of Brooks and VanVleet, everybody in their rotation is pretty much 23 or younger. Jalen Green is 22, Şengün 22, Jabari 21, Thompson 22, Eason 23, Reed Shepherd is 20. Like, they have the looks of that next up-and-coming young team that's taken the league by storm and, like, ends up kind of winning way more games than you expect them to, just like Orlando and Indiana did last year, just like Oklahoma City did the year before that, and, I mean, again, Oklahoma City did last year as well, Minnesota last year. Like, there's just always these teams that kind of come out of nowhere where people are like, oh, yeah, they could be pretty good, 7 or 8 seed, and then they end up being, like, the 2 or 3 seed. So the question is, with Houston, obviously, are they a lock to make the playoffs? And I'm not going to go that far yet. I think they are likely to make the playoffs. I think that as of right now, they have a really good chance to be in the 4 or 5 seed range. I'm not quite ready to put them in the 2 to 3 seed area quite yet, even though that's where they are right now. But I still have my concerns. As I said preseason, I'm not a Jalen Green guy, and I still think they are winning in spite of Jalen Green this so far this season. He's shooting 39% from the field, and he's taking the most shots on the team, and he's 32% from three. Like, he is just not an efficient, reliable first option, but they're still treating him as the first option. So as long as he is the first option on the team, I'm going to have major hesitancies with Houston. But it's such a bummer because I love almost everything else about this team. I'm like such a Şengün guy. I think he is at worst going to be basically the next Domantas Sabonis and could even be better than him because he's still only 22 and putting up basically the same stats as Sabonis is. I love what Eason is doing. I still believe in Jabari Smith as a really high-level starter in this league. You guys know how I feel about Reed Shepherd. I think he has all-star level potential. Like, I love so much about this roster, but Jalen Green is the one thing that's just, I can't get there with him. I haven't seen it. It feels like he hasn't improved at all since he came into the league. He was an inefficient high-volume scorer, and he's still an inefficient high-volume scorer. And I don't know. I wish they could trade him for somebody that's a better fit. And then I'd be probably all in on this Houston team. But because of that, I can't sit here and be shocked if they fall to the 7 or 8 seed and then lose in the play-in or something like that. Like, I just can't rule it out because they're the 3 seed right now, but there are a lot of really good teams behind them still. I'm sure nobody thinks Minnesota is going to finish as the 10 seed, which is where they are right now. I'm sure nobody thinks Dallas is going to finish as the 9 seed, which is where they are right now. Phoenix is the 6 seed, and they were 8-1 before they started getting all these injuries. So they seemed like a legitimate team before that. Denver, for as much as we've talked about them struggling, they're still 8-5. They still have Jokic. Like, they still obviously could finish ahead of a team like Houston. The Lakers are 10-5 right behind the Rockets. So there's a lot of teams that could pass them. And there's a lot of teams that if faced with a one-game play-in scenario, you might trust them more than Houston. Like, if you're telling me if it's Luka versus a Jalen Green and Rockets team in a one-game play-in, you're picking Luka. You're picking the Mavs. Same with Anthony Edwards and Minnesota. Same with Jokic and Denver. Same with Booker and KD and Phoenix. Like, these teams, they've just got a better, more reliable star power than the Rockets do. And so that's my hesitancy. I think they can make the playoffs. I do. I really do. But I think that their best path to doing so is getting a top 6 seed because I think they will not be favored in any of the play-in scenarios just because of their inexperience. Not to say that they couldn't still make it, but I have worries about them with Jalen Green being such a prominent part of the team. And until he's not, I'm going to just continue to have some hesitancy unless we see some more consistency out of him. But not a lock to make the playoffs, but still a team that probably likely makes the playoffs. The next question is the sample size big enough to say that Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner are both taking the leap in the same season? And it's possible. It is certainly on the table, in my opinion, because both these guys have been spectacular so far this season. I mean, Paolo obviously is still injured. He's got weeks to go before he's back. 4 to 6 weeks is when they said he would be reevaluated. That was back around Halloween. So we're about 3 weeks into that, probably another 2 to 3 weeks before we get an update on him. So it could be even longer till he's back. But I mean, the guy dropped a 50-point game with 13 rebounds, 9 assists on 62% shooting. He had been averaging 29, 9, and 6 on 50% from the field. Looked like a legitimate superstar doing it, too. I mean, just his feel for the game as a passer and a playmaker. Just like a guy who coming in the league was almost advertised as a ball stopper. Couldn't be anything further from that. He is such a player who can go get his own shot, but makes the right pass, plays within the offense, terrifying getting downhill, going to the basket, particularly elite in transition, and his shot just has continued to improve. So I've always thought Paolo had top 10 player in the league, superstar upside. I picked him to take the leap this year. It looked like he was doing it, but obviously we'll have to withhold too much judgment till he comes back and we can see him do it some more. But the more surprising or impressive part of this to me is probably the Franz Wagner part because the dude's been awesome. There's no other way around it so far this season. He's averaging 23 points, 6 rebounds, 5 assists, 47% from the field. That three-point shot is back to about where it's been for his career, 35%. So those concerns about it being broken are mostly alleviated. But just in the past few games, I mean, 37 points, 32 points, 31 points, 29 points, 32 points, 23, 27, 28. I mean, the guy's putting up 25-plus on almost a nightly basis in recent weeks since Paolo went down. But he's also increased his playmaking. He's versatile as hell on both sides of the ball as a guy that can play on the ball, off the ball, good in transition, a lengthy defender that can guard the perimeter really well, can hang down low a little bit, can guard smaller players. Like, he's kind of a jack-of-all-trades, like, does-it-all sort of guy. And that was the question, is, like, he's pretty good at everything, but is he ever going to be really good enough at anything to be that all-star level player? And I still wouldn't necessarily say he's found his calling card as, like, I'm extremely elite at this one thing. But if he just continues to get better and better and better at basically every facet of the game, then it at a certain point, it's going to be pretty hard to not say this guy is close to an all-star if he's strongly above average at every aspect and continues to impress as a high usage ball, more ball dominant guy, which was kind of one of the questions with him, is could he do that in an elevated role? And I had my doubts about him as even a number two option, but with his recent stretch, I mean, he's just been so crazy impressive, just taking over games late, hitting the game winning shot against the Lakers this week, took over against Phoenix down the stretch of that game earlier this week as well. Like, I don't know what else you could want to see out of this guy, given where Orlando is at the standings. I mean, people thought they would probably plummet once Paolo got hurt, and honestly, rightfully so, just given the fact that he was out. But they have won 6 of their last 7 games with wins over the Lakers, the Suns, the Pacers, just to name a few. And their defense is obviously insanely good, but for them to be 10-7 with Paolo having missed all that time, and look, their next few games, Pistons, Hornets, Bulls, Nets, like, those are all super winnable. I wouldn't be shocked if they won 5 out of their next 6, and then they're sitting there at 15-8, and then Paolo's coming back pretty soon. So they could legitimately be a top 2-3 seed in the Eastern Conference. In fact, I think it's likely they're at least in the top 4, if not top 3. I know Boston and Cleveland have built up pretty healthy leads so far, but obviously there's a lot of time left. But back to the question of if they're both taking a leap, and as I said, it's on the table. I want to see it a little bit more out of Franz. I think that Paolo's natural progression makes sense. So, like, I still think that he is essentially going to continue to take the leap this season from, like, a young, up-and-coming potential superstar into, like, a legitimate perennial all-star. I mean, he made an all-star game last year. I think he can make All-NBA this year. Can Franz make an all-star team? It's possible, but he's going to need to continue to do what he's doing. So I guess I would say the sample size is too small to proclaim that, to say for sure they're both doing it, but I think it is a possibility. I don't think it's a, like, you got to rule that one out sort of thing, because they're still both super young and they're both super good, and this is a really good team that I was probably wrong about them. I thought that they would maybe be too lackluster offensively to be the breakout team and then top 3, top 2 seed that a lot of people thought they could be. But clearly they are good enough there, because I think Suggs has taken a little bit of a step up. KCP hasn't shot it well, but even just having him out there has helped spread the floor more. But it all comes down to these two guys. And if Franz is going to be a 23 a game guy on good efficiency, that's creating his own shot, making the right play offensively, and Paolo's going to be a 25-30 point per game guy that is just a beast with the ball in his hands as a triple threat, then yeah, I mean, they're going to be a tough out, a top 3-4 seed in the East, and probably the favorite in the East right now outside of Cleveland and Boston to make a run. And they match up pretty well with those teams just because of how good defensively they are as well. So it is possible that they're both taking the leap, but I think maybe a little too early to say for sure. The next one is the sample size big enough to say that the Suns have a serious center problem. And I'm not even thinking twice about this one. It is absolutely big enough to say that, because Jusuf Nurkić has been a disaster for this team so far. I mean, just looking at his stats alone, he has more than twice as many turnovers as assists this season. His scoring is down. His rebounding is down. He is shooting 40% from the field, 30% from three on the highest volume that he's ever had, and only 48% from two. I've talked about this in the past. He is maybe the worst finishing big man in the league, but just to put into perspective, here are just some of the players that have shot better from two-point range than the 7-foot-tall Jusuf Nurkić: Bub Carrington, the rookie in Washington; Tim Hardaway Jr.; notoriously very efficient D'Angelo Russell; Kevin Porter Jr.; the other notoriously very efficient Fred VanVleet; Shake Milton; Julian Strother. I mean, it is pathetic. The guys that are shoot, those guys are all tiny guards that shoot jump shots and are all super inefficient in general. And these are the players who have a higher field goal percentage than the 7-foot Jusuf Nurkić. Scoot Henderson, who has by all accounts been a disaster from the field in his first year plus; Davion Mitchell, a undersized combo guard; Johnny Juzang, a guy who was a two-way player last year, again, predominantly jump shooting player; Ron Holland, a guy who is a total project offensively, still a rookie and 10 games into his career; Tim Hardaway Jr. again; Malik Beasley; Kyle Kuzma; and of course, Jordan McLaughlin. Those are the guys that are shooting better than Jusuf Nurkić this year. So he has been, just in every possible facet of the game, a disaster offensively. Just cannot make shots, cannot finish plays, turning the ball over like crazy. And normally a good connective piece, assist guy, he's been anything but that this year. That part of his game has fallen off a cliff. And again, it's not like he's really making up for it on the defensive end, because while he's maybe not an awful, awful, awful defensive player, he's not a good one. He's not above average. He's average at best, and he's just a big body. He's not he's too slow-footed to keep up on the perimeter. He's not a shot blocker or rim protector, really. And so what does this guy bring into the team? And unfortunately, they don't have many other options. Oso Iguodaro is a rookie. He's shown some flashes as a good athlete, a really good passer. He's been a really good connective piece for the team. But unfortunately, he's just a little undersized, and he's also not much of a defensive player down low in the paint. Then you've got Mason Plumlee, who, you know, he's probably outplayed Nurkić to this point, but he is what he is. He's just a guy that can go out there, give you 20 minutes. He can just kind of defend the paint. He can finish a little better than Nurkić does, a little bit more of a lob threat, but doesn't stretch the floor at all. And again, still not really a shot blocker. And so they just don't have options at center that they need. And Bol Bol can't do that. You can't ask Kevin Durant to play center for like an entire game. And I don't see the answer on the roster. And I really like what they have otherwise. I think the Booker, Beal, Durant trio has looked really solid this season. I think Tyus Jones has been like a really, really good pickup for them. He's just been a very consistent shooter, helped them with some of their turnover issues and the fourth quarter issues. Royce O'Neal, having a full season of him, has been great as a glue guy, 3-and-D player. Ryan Dunn has obviously shown flashes on both ends of the court. Like, they've got a lot of good pieces. Grayson Allen hasn't even really shot the ball well to this point, but we know what he's capable of. But they got to go external if they want to contend, because they just do not have a center on this team, and they need to upgrade it. They need to upgrade it. It's a weird time in the NBA where, look, you don't need an all-star at center, but if you are a team with a center that's a liability, you're cooked. You got no chance. Look at all the good defensive teams, and then also just good teams in general that are contending. They all have competent centers, at least guys that can defend the paint, at least guys that can spread the floor, like one of those things, if not preferably both. And Phoenix doesn't have anyone that does both. And Phoenix doesn't really even have one that does one of those things. So if they want to contend, they need to get a center. The sample size is plenty big enough on Yusuf Nurkic that he cannot be the guy for this team. And they're going to have to add somebody, and they don't have a ton of flexibility to do it, but Robert Williams is out there. If Mark Williams is maybe available, Nick Richards, even a Jonas Valanciunas, I'm not even sure that that would fix any of those issues, but just naming some of the guys that they maybe could go get, because at this point, any of them would be upgrades over Nurkic, because he's killing him out there on both ends, and especially come playoff times, it's only going to be amplified. The next question is the sample size big enough to say that the Clippers are kind of good, and that if Kawhi Leonard was healthy, then they'd be a legitimate threat in the Western Conference? And I was out on this team. One of my semi-bold predictions was that they would be the 13th seed in the West. They would be a mess. They wouldn't be able to do anything offensively. They would just fall apart without Kawhi out there. And they certainly haven't done that. They are 9-7. And not only are they 9-7, they've got some damn good wins so far this season. I mean, they've beaten the Nuggets. They've beaten Golden State twice. They beat the Sixers. They've beaten the Kings. They beat the Magic. And they even have like an overtime loss to the Suns, barely lost to the Suns a second time. Lost another close one of the Thunder. So they've just been super competitive across the board. And the biggest reasons for that are, number one, their defense, which has been sixth best in the NBA to this point in terms of defensive rating. And they've just been, that's how they've won their games. They've been smothering to teams. The additions of guys like Chris Dunn, Derek Jones Jr., have just been paying dividends for them on top of other good defenders they already had, like Amir Coffey's very solid there, Terrence Mann, Nicholas Batum, who they also added. So they've been really good on that end, and that's really been their calling card, which really was the only way they were going to be competitive, was if they were really good defensively, and so that part of it kind of has held up. The next one is the just complete out-of-nowhere emergence of Norman Powell. I did not see this coming out of him, out of a guy who is 31 years old at this point and has never averaged 20 points per game in his career at any point. And this year is up to 23.3 points per game. And not only is the volume way up, but his efficiency is among the best it's ever been. I mean, 49% from the field. He's shooting 49% from three-point range on 8 attempts per game. I don't know how sustainable that is. He's 40% for his career. But, I mean, anyone who saw this coming out of Norman Powell, then kudos to you. But it is just crazy to see a guy in his early 30s just kind of break out, and makes you wonder if maybe he could have done something like this in a more expanded role at some point in his career. But obviously he hadn't had the opportunity yet. But outside of him as well, I think a lot of this comes back to Ty Lue, and just it's well documented how good of a coach he has been. I know that it's hard to see it sometimes because the Clippers have just been really unlucky with injuries with Kawhi and Paul George and other players. But this, he just gets the most out of teams like this, especially it feels like, when they're a little bit undermanned, and he always has the right adjustments. He's got really good schemes on both ends of the court. And so now they sit here at 9-7 with a hodgepodge group of James Harden and Norman Powell and a bunch of role players. Zubats has also played really well for them, averaging 15-12. And Harden has done what he can, but he's not been efficient because people are throwing bodies at him on the offense, on the defensive end of the court. He's shooting only 37% from the field, 32% from deep, but still just under 9 assists a game, 20 points, 8 rebounds. And so going back to the question is, can this team maybe do something if they have Kawhi that comes back at some point? And I think the answer is probably yes. I mean, it's not even just that they're 9-7. It's the eye test of them being competitive in so many games. They're an annoying team to play. If they're playing your favorite team, you're kind of thinking, oh, the Clippers suck, we should win this easy. And then that's not what happens most of the time. You're at least going to have a close game in most matchups against them. And so between that, the emergence of Norman Powell doing pretty much all the scoring that they would have needed out of a guy like Paul George, who they signed, James Harden still orchestrating the offense, the defense looking way better than it has in previous years, just because they improved with their perimeter prowess on that end. And Kawhi coming back, if he can even be like close to what he was last year, I know that might be a lot to ask. And the fact that we have no idea when he's coming back, it could be weeks, it could be months, it could be maybe not this year. Like, normally I'd say that's a ridiculous thing to say, but with Kawhi Leonard, you really never know with how ambiguous these injuries tend to be. And so if he comes back and can be his normal 24-point-per-game self with pretty good defense, good rebounder, a little bit of playmaking, and efficient shooting, then, I mean, they certainly seem good enough to at least make some noise. And by that, I mean, like, could they either play a very competitive first-round series or even win a series? It's possible, just because I think that there's no, like, really, really strong team in the West this year. There's a lot of really good teams, but everybody's kind of got some sort of fatal flaw. And so there is opportunity to win series in the West this season, despite how strong it is. So we'll see if and when Kawhi can come back. But I do think it's safe to say at this point that the Clippers are not the awful 30-win team that a lot of people, myself included, thought they would be, but instead a team that's going to be competitive, that could potentially get in the play-in even without Kawhi, but with him, I think would be a shoe-in to do so. And it just depends when he comes back and what he looks like when he comes back as well. But assuming health for him at some point in the season, I think that the Clippers are going to be a tough out and an annoying team to play down the stretch, because they've already kind of been that to this point. So, and the very last question we have is the sample size big enough to say that the NBA needs to consider abolishing conferences and just seeding the playoff teams 1 through 16? And to me, this is a resounding yes, because the sample size is not just 15 games, which is how far we are into this season. The sample size for this being true is 25 years. So this season alone, the East currently has 4 teams over 500, and the West has 11, which is a drastic difference. The West record versus the East this year is 41-22. That is a 65% win percentage, which over the span of a full season will put you at about 53 wins, which would be one of the best records in the NBA. So basically, when the West plays the East, they are one of the, every team collectively is one of the best teams in the NBA. Every single team in the West, except for the Pelicans, has at least a 500 record against the East this year. So only one team does not. Even the 3-12 Utah Jazz have a 500 record versus the East this year. Every other team either has the same 500 record or a better record. So they have just been dominant across the board versus the East. And then if you just look over the last 25 years, which is what I was getting to, the West has had a winning record versus the East in 22 out of 25 seasons this century. They have had a winning percentage of 60% or better in 4 of those 25 years, which, again, that puts it at a very healthy win pace. They've had a 55% or better win percentage in 16 of the 25 seasons, which, again, even that is 45 win pace, which is certainly good enough to get a team in the playoff most years. And then over the entire span, they've had a 55.9% win percentage. So basically, right at 56% is what the West has been versus the East this entire century. Just to put in more perspective, there's been 15 times this century that the East has had a team below 500 make the playoffs. In that same span, the West has had zero. Not a single below 500 team in the West has made the postseason this century. And among those 15 teams in the East, there's been teams to win as few as 36 games and still get into the postseason. On the contrary, the West has had 18 teams that had an above 500 record and missed the playoffs. In that span, the East has only had 4. So 18-4 in terms of 500 or above 500 teams that have missed the playoffs. And we've had teams with as many as 48 wins in the West miss the playoffs, and that's happened multiple times, nearly 50 wins and still couldn't get in. We've had 28 times it this century, where a team in the West would have made the playoffs in the East, but ended up missing it. And that's been as many as three in one season. On the contrary, that's only happened three times total for Eastern teams that would have made it in the West but didn't in the East. So 28 times in 25 years, that's more than one per year. So we're basically saying that every single season there's a team that makes the playoffs in the East that wouldn't in the West and vice versa, which, of course, those teams are always the 8 seed or 7 seed or around that range. So it's not likely changing the outlook on the overall championship picture. But the point is, do we really want a product where we're putting these 38 win teams in the East in the playoffs every year? Do we really want a team to win 48 games and be left out of the postseason, not even have a chance? One of the years that a team won 48 and missed in the West, they would have been the 3 seed in the East. The 3 seed. So that right there just shows how lopsided it has been. And of course, the theory by many people who don't believe in this as maybe a good idea have said, well, it'll even out over time, but it hasn't. It hasn't. I mean, you look this year, the West is significantly better than the East. You go back a decade, they were significantly better. You go back a decade before that, they were significantly better. It has been, it's been a strange phenomenon that's happened. The fact that it's been so lopsided, you would think over time it would start to even out, but it just hasn't for whatever reason. There's just been more star power in the West. There's been more good teams across the board. There's been more depth in the conference. And so I think that it is time, especially with expansion coming up, which of course is rumored to be happening in the next few years with two new teams being added, with 32 teams total. I think it makes perfect sense to, in tandem, switch to eliminating conferences. And I know travel is kind of the big thing of like, well, teams got to travel more, it's more difficult, but that's fine. Just give kind of a couple extra days in the playoffs off for each team, and I think it would be totally fine. They're used to traveling throughout the season anyway, and they're still going to have, it's still a series, so you're going to have multiple games at home before you travel, then multiple games at their place. So I don't think it's going to make a huge difference. But the other argument is like with rivalries, talking about if like Celtics Lakers have played in the finals a bunch, and you'd be like, well, we wouldn't get stuff like that as much. Well, sure, but they would play more often. So in a way, it's actually kind of making the rivalries better a little bit, because the Lakers and Celtics, I mean, they've played twice this century in the finals. I know they had the long run where they were so dominant before, but it hasn't happened very much otherwise. But then you could have Celtics Lakers in the first round, something like that, which could be cool, especially because if that would mean one of the teams isn't very good and one of them is, but at least you're like getting more of that, those rivalry games happening, and you could build some more new rivalries, which would be cool. So I think that it's about time that we consider this. I think the sample size is not only big enough this season, but big enough over the span of 25 years, as I mentioned. And I do think that the NBA has been more willing to experiment with different things with the All-Star new format that's rumored to be 4 teams with sort of tournament style. They tried the Elam ending. They've been willing to experiment with different things, different replay rules. And so I think that this is a logical next step. It'd be pretty drastic, but I mean, we've had divisions and conferences change in the past. And with the rumors that Vegas and Seattle will be the 2 teams added in the expansion, they're going to have to switch the conferences up slightly. Obviously, someone would have to move east. And it just feels unfair for these Western Conference teams, where you've got 12 really good teams and two of them aren't even going to make the play-in. And then you've got in the East, like, there's going to be some team that makes the play-in that is just not good at all. So I think the sample size is certainly big enough to say that. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Thank you so much for listening. We're about a month into the season, as I mentioned, so probably going to take a little bit of a holiday break with Thanksgiving coming up, but we'll definitely do something in December, right around when the NBA Cup is really getting into the thick of things. We've got some more pool play games tonight. And then the tournament with the bracket will actually take place early December. So I think we'll have some more coverage of that once we get to that time. But thank you so much again for listening, and I will chat with you soon.
Thank you.